Do you think life is simpler after you retire? For some, it's actually more complicated when facing issues about health, estate plans, probate, long-term care, and more. That's why attorney CPA Joe Cordell hosts Elder Talk with Joe Cordell, providing smart solutions for seniors and an open forum for older adults with important questions about their future. Here's attorney CPA Joe Cordell.
Welcome to another episode of Elder Talk. This week, we're going to blend two areas of the law that I have a lot of familiarity with. Many of you know that the early part of my career as a lawyer was spent in divorce law. Many of you have heard of Cordell and Cordell. And you also know, of course, that the last 10 years or so, I have practiced an area called elder law. And really, that's the subject, of course, of this show. But it's interesting that we came across an article. In fact, there have been a couple of articles written that talk about the graying of divorce. So kind of it's the intersection of two areas of the law that I know something about and in which I have an interest. So we thought that we would kind of take hold of this topic and discuss it in a way that we think is useful and interesting.
Well, that's right, Joe. We have done a little bit of research. And so surprisingly, over the past quarter century, of the divorce among couples 25 to 39, that's decreased. That's good news for marriages, right?
Yeah, and we never thought we'd see that happen.
We did not. 21% is how much that decreased. And the rate of divorce among adults 50 and older, which is referred to as the gray divorce, that's kind of the definition that we
age
use.
Age 50 and older.
Age 50 and older. Okay, are you ready for this statistic? It has risen 109%, according to Pew Research. So this is obviously something that is taking place. Now, these aren't the marriages most of the time that have been, 5 years or less, 10 years or less, something like that. Many of these marriages have been entire lifetimes together, 20 years, 30 years. We see it in the newspapers and that type of thing. So that's going to affect the way you plan and your retirement.
Yeah, and you know, divorce is something that anytime you do it in your life, of course, it's very disruptive. It's disruptive in emotional ways and lots of intangible ways. But we want to focus primarily on the very tangible ways in which divorce is disruptive, and especially as it would impact someone later in life. Wherever you are in life, divorce is expensive. Mm-hmm. You essentially take 50% of what you have accumulated together. You divide it up. It means that you're in a position where what formerly was supporting one household now has to support two households. And then, of course, where there are minor children involved, it means stretching those dollars further. So the reality is, despite the ambitions of legislatures and judges to keep the standards of living the same, especially for the children, it's simply not there because the economics are not there. So it does mean hardship typically for everybody. Mm-hmm. It's not to say that divorce is never the right answer, but I would suggest that it should be the last available solution for the vast majority of people, and especially where there are children involved. However, while you can go through a divorce, have your net worth cut in half, have those claims on your income that might come through child support or maintenance, attorney fees, and still recover when you're in your 30s. Mm-hmm. That's very conceivable. And people, in fact, manage to do that. It's a hard road. It's not a road you'd prefer. Mm-hmm. But for people who find themselves there, many involuntarily, I should add, they manage to shoulder that responsibility, and often they do recover in a decade or two. Mm-hmm. What's different about what we're talking about here today, the graying of divorce, is that it's occurring at a time in your life when you're perhaps in the least strong position to recover financially. And often it means that retirement plans are broken mm-hmm. into pieces. Mm-hmm. There are transaction costs associated with marriage with divorce, incidentally. By that I mean there are fees paid to a variety of people, whether it's realtors, lawyers especially, mm-hmm. but others, financial advisors, CPAs. There are costs that come into play that erode what was the original principal amount of the marital assets. But also, there's simply the fact that you're now setting up these two households we talked about, and there's an unknown. you now potentially face alone, long-term care costs. You don't know when they're going to hit. You may think when you're 55, well, I'll worry about that in 35 years.
Right.
But you may be worrying about it in 10 years.
Right.
Or less.
Or less.
I mean, lots of things can happen when we're in our late 50s and going into our 60s. So that is an element that needs consideration. I mean, when you have a partnership, that partnership, rocky though it may be, will withhold and will survive at least, or will serve as a benefit to both parties. Even marriages that are not great.
Right.
I mean, we do that for each other. We do it almost instinctively.
You tend to just rely on each other. You know, you know that someone there has your back a little bit. Even if it's you've had a fight the day before, that when you really need them, they're going to at least show up at the hospital, or they're going to be there to kind of help take care of the things at home or manage the things at home.
Yeah, it is. It's a big adjustment.
Mm-hmm.
And I can tell you that the grieving process associated with divorce is compared to the death of a child. I've heard that analogy made clients, to the death of a spouse. I mean, it's a wretching sort of thing, and especially when you've had a marriage for many years.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what the health impact of the stress, even if you assume for a moment, hey, I'm not going to be one of those that's going to grieve. And that may be true, but I can tell you'll go through a lot of stress during the course of a divorce. There's so much uncertainty. And depending on the extent to which there's disagreement, I mean, this could be something that's wrapped up in a couple of months, very optimistically, but in a couple of months in which one party files a petition for divorce, there's an answer, it has to be filed within 30 days, and then you have a period of time for a settlement conference during which sometimes parties, in the best of circumstances, they'll work out a settlement agreement. And so you walk that settlement agreement into the court, then the judge looks at it, proves it, signs it, and the parties may or may not testify, and that's that. So that's the extraordinary situation.
And yet that's just the one piece of it, because when you walk out of that courtroom, your life is forever changed.
Very good point.
The lives of your children are forever changed. Holidays are going to look different. Birthdays are going to look different. Weddings will look different. I mean, that's one of those things. Your retirement will look different.
Yes.
So even in the best of scenarios and the best of situations, there will be changes and things that you need to deal with.
Yeah, yeah. It's like a heavy dose of radiation, maybe. You know, you may feel fine for a while and think that was easy, and then the problems develop. So I think that many people are shocked when they see the impact on their financial statements and on their income and the challenges they face in meeting their monthly expenses. Life is different after divorce, definitely. But the process itself can be very, very difficult. What I described for you is very unusual.
Mm-hmm.
Don't expect that. The other end, and often the more common, especially for marriages that have survived for several decades, because there's more complexity, there's often more animosity, more conflict, too, that arises. Often, incidentally, somebody is wanting out.
Mm-hmm.
Usually it's not mutual. I'll say these graying divorces are more often than not, I'm going to suggest, not a truly mutual decision. The probability is that one party is wanting to move on and the other at best is acquiescing.
Mm-hmm.
At worst is going to be as obstructionist as possible.
Right.
A feeling that I understand depending on the circumstances. So it can be a wretching experience itself. In addition to the cost financially, there can be the emotional cost. There can be the uncertainty, a tunnel which you enter and you're wondering when you're going to come out. In Missouri, for the most part, divorces are completed in a year. It's unusual for them to go much beyond a year, but it does sometimes happen. I'll say that primarily for St. Louis County. In more rural parts of the state, it might be common for it to go closer to 2 years than 1 year. And in many states, it's routine for it to go 2 years, and the 1 year might be the exception. So divorce, the period of time that people spend in this period of life when they don't know what the outcome's going to be for sure, and as a result, they can't plan. That's a difficult period of time, and that pipeline can be significant. And there's no question, I don't want to dwell on this, but stress at any time in your life has real consequences to your health.
Oh yeah.
And they're real. And you may not see them immediately, but they do take their toll. And I would argue that for people at a point in their life when they're in their 50s or 60s and they're going through this process, I mean, it's tough when you're 30, but I can't imagine how difficult it would be going through that in your 60s. But I know some people listen to this show, you may be hostage to a process you didn't choose.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not going to speak to people here as if, you know, both of you have equal power to make a decision about whether to save your marriage, because the reality is it just takes one person to mm-hmm. choose divorce, and the other is along for the ride, more or less. But I did think, though, that this article raised some very interesting things to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we are dedicated to the subject of elder talk and the needs of the elderly and the challenges financially, as well as health care and other things. And all those things are on the table. Mm-hmm. Everything's on the table when you're talking about divorce.
So let's say you are in a situation and you've been married several years. Let's say it was a traditional setting where the husband did most of the work and maybe perhaps made most of the income. The wife stayed home to take care of the children. Are they going to have a division of assets 50-50? A pension fund that might be in the husband's name, is that going to become an area of contention, or is most of the time the court going to just say, okay, we're going to split everything 50-50 and you go on your way and then you go from that point?
Well, let me say as a general rule that whatever assets are acquired during the course of the marriage, they're going to be a marital asset. That means that retirement benefits, if you had one person who's a homemaker, for example, that June and Ward Cleaver scenario, which is less common today, but mm-hmm. but in this age group may not have been that uncommon. And for them, the assets that Ward would have accumulated on the job are going to be owned equally. So it means that there's a device called a quadro, a qualified domestic relations order, and that's a tool by which you divide up retirement benefits, tax-deferred assets without triggering tax consequences. Sometimes that's money, though, that the parties need. And if handled correctly, if it's the right type of asset, it's possible that one party, usually the party who's on the receiving end of half, will be able to access some of that to meet urgent needs in the short term. But all the other assets, furnishings, savings, real estate, the house, those things are going to be marital assets. And when you don't have minor children, the court, for the most part, is not going to allow one party to keep an asset because they just want to, usually. Now, if the other party agrees, then the court's happy to pretty much sign whatever agreement the parties reach. But when there's a disagreement and say that the wife wants to stay in the marital home, that's fine if she has the ability to pay off the existing mortgage and take the husband off the debt. The court's not likely to send him off with no minor children and still being on the debt. If maybe the husband wants to keep his pension plan, that's not an unusual
mm-hmm.
deal that's struck sometimes in settlement discussions, is maybe the person who has earned most of the 401k, they may say, well, look, I'd like to keep that. I'll trade the equity in the house. That decision has to be made with an eye to the tax consequences because you're giving tax-deferred money to the retirement assets that may not be available on the house. So you do have a tax deferral of sorts. You have the fact that the equity accumulates without taxation. You have a stepped-up basis to the extent that there's a death and a transfer in that asset. You also have the ability to avoid capital gains on a transfer if you buy a new home within the 2 to 5 year period. So there are tax deferral advantages, but those have to be compared to those that are being enjoyed by the person who's keeping their pension plan. Taxes always have to be a piece of the discussion.
If someone is staying in the marital home, is a normal or a common occurrence that for them to have to provide some compensation to the spouse who is not staying in the marital home, financially, some of the equity? Do they just need to pay them? How does that normally get resolved?
Well, yeah, the other party is entitled to credit. Now, again, if the parties agree on nothing, then the judge will just order things sold. When you don't have minor children, the court doesn't need to make accommodations for existing home and neighborhood and school and all that. So the court will just order everything sold. That's the easiest way to do it. and then the parties split the money. But in a case where there is some conversation or some sort of settlement, which is the majority of cases, but it's also the majority of cases that they don't settle immediately.
Yeah.
they settle sometime, you know. So that settlement, I don't want to suggest to people that you often have a deal in 60 days. You often have a deal in a year in 60 days. But anyway, so when that deal is struck, then, it might be that the wife gets to stay there if she's the one who wants the home. She pays equity out to him, perhaps through an existing account. They'll trade off assets. It could be, as I was giving the example of the 401k, trading off those two assets. But he's going to insist that he come off that existing note because it will haunt his credit report. Now, there could be some quid pro quo where he would say, okay, I'll let her stay there. I'll stay on the note. Let's have language that if she gets 30 days behind, then I'm allowed to come in or take possession of the home or force a sale or things that are intended to protect his credit.
Mm-hmm.
But he may be willing to do that if she's willing to accommodate him by perhaps waiving some claim to some other asset. So deals are generally a combination of a bunch of sacrifices as well as benefits that are exchanged as part of the settlement.
It's just sad all the way around. I actually knew someone that they apparently they couldn't come to a conclusion, I guess. And the judge did order everything sold. I mean, down to the linens in the kitchen. They were selling the dish towels and the kitchen table and all of the things, every piece of property, and that they had to sell and then split equally. And I thought, gosh, they had been married. They are an example. They had been married 30-something years and no minor children at home. And, it's just,
it's a shame.
It is a shame. I would say work toward that goal.
Well, and as we read these statistics about the graying divorce, we can speculate a little bit, although the evidence does suggest that these, incidentally, are either marriages that are first marriages, meaning they've been around a long time, or they're second marriages that have been around a long time, meaning these are not people who married at age 50 and are getting divorced at age 55.
Right.
Some of them are, but the bulk of these numbers, it appears, are people who've been married for longer periods of time. So it looks almost like they made the decision that they were going to stay together for the kids, I'm guessing.
Mm-hmm.
That I see that as a common argument. And incidentally, I don't disagree with staying together for the kids. And once you've stayed together that long, you might ask yourself, look, we made it this far, 30 years. Can we not make it another 30?
Mm-hmm.
But it's not as if you can compare the two 30. Some people say, well, yeah, we made it together for 30 years, so I'm going to spend the next 30 with someone else. But it doesn't work out that way for the reasons we've talked about already,
right,
in addition to other reasons. But it's not the same thing. When you're 55 years old, you're not in a position to start a new life. It's naive to believe that without consequence financially and emotionally and health and relationships, as you just talked about, Susan, it's naive to believe that you can do that as if you're 25 and starting out on a 30-year adventure.
Mm-hmm. And those second marriages, they have even a greater percentage. Those are failing even more frequently than the first marriages. They just have a greater percentage of failure, and a third marriage is even worse. So,
and you have to agree with a little bit of caution, though, what appears to be good news, and that's that the counterpoint to this article, which incidentally I think we said it appeared both in Forbes as well as Wall Street Journal.
Right. There's an article in Forbes, and then there's also in Wall Street Journal. They both talk about this. But if you just Google it, you'll find all kinds of statistics about the graying divorce rate and things like that.
So the cause potentially for optimism, it's suggested by these researchers, is that there appears to be a lower divorce rate for those who are younger.
Mm-hmm.
But you need to parse that carefully, because the fact is many of these younger people are living together and not getting married.
Right.
And so they're marrying in smaller numbers. But they also, and I think this is more positive given the world we live in, is that fewer people are getting married at 18, 19, and 20. I think that while it worked decades ago, it worked for many of our parents who had long, happy marriages. I can see where today it is a different world, and it's probably a mistake for most people. So now what we're seeing more commonly, as suggested in this article, is that age 27 is an average marriage age for women, and 29, I think, for men.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's probably wise. I think I have two daughters. What are they? 22 and 21.
Mm-hmm.
So I couldn't imagine they're getting married now.
No.
I would tend to think, give them another, is 30 years too long?
Well, that's the dad in you speaking, I think.
Okay, give them another 7 years or so.
Although I have a 22-year-old male at my house, so I'm not sure he's ready to get married right now either.
So, but this waiting does mean that couples know more about each other.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of change that takes place between age 18 and 27.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Now, as we head back into the graying divorces, you know, we've talked a little bit about some of the costs with that. So one of the things that we've talked about is that you have less time to recover. So it seems that what many, many people are going to be doing is they're going to be working later and later, and maybe into their 60s, 70s. Maybe they had thought that they would retire at 70, but they're still working at 75 or something like that, where they are still trying to recover from that just for daily living expenses.
Well, let's review again, though, those things that impact financially these couples. There are what I call transaction costs. And by that, I just mean all those things associated with the changes that are taking place during and after the divorce process. During the divorce process, somebody has set up temporary housing somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
They're probably living somewhere else. Well, the court's going to allow them support for that if they don't earn it, so the other party's paying them support. Even if they're paying the other party support, the court's going to acknowledge that they're having to pay this their own rent now somewhere, so that's less money available to pay the other party support. The bottom line is, if you think of this marital money as a single pool, you're going to have lots of money that's being eroded during the course of the divorce process,
mm-hmm,
in various ways. I mentioned the attorney fees, huge. It's not unusual to spend, I'll shock some people, but you don't have to be rich to spend $100,000 in a divorce.
Yikes.
I mean, you don't have to be rich to do that, and especially where there are children involved. But I would argue in this case, where there's a couple who are older and they have a lot of financial entanglements,
mm-hmm,
maybe even a business, geez, you can have business appraisal experts who consume $25,000, $30,000 in costs. So I'm just pointing out that the decision to get divorced itself, coupled with all the things that will come with that, the moving,
mm-hmm,
the two households, the doubling up on the insurance and other costs that formerly you got some discounts by doing joint purchases.
Mm-hmm.
Think of all those things in your life that you benefit doing them jointly versus what the cost would be individually. So that is a significant percentage of your total marital estate. Now look at coming out, the cost of the two households,
mm-hmm,
and look at the other things that you're going to face. So are you going to make up, bridge the shortfall in funds by getting a part-time job?
Mm-hmm.
And that's a lifestyle change. It might be that one of the parties is to receive maintenance.
Mm-hmm.
And that means perhaps that the other party is having to go work longer than they otherwise would. But I can tell you, maintenance awards are rarely so generous.
Oh, is that right?
That are rarely so generous that they allow a comfortable existence on the part of the other party. Now, I will tell you, though, that when you have someone who is that old, if we assume that someone is 60 years old and has been a homemaker, and that's often the stereotype, then in that case, I can tell you a judge is not inclined to require them to qualify themselves for a new career. However, a judge is also, if they're healthy, not going to allow them to sit and clip coupons at the expense of their ex-husband either.
Mm-hmm.
So that there would be some imputation of income. Imputation just means the court's going to say, well, what could this person earn as at least a minimum wage employee? So you people who are getting divorced in the circumstances where they're 55 and older, depending on how much older, may very well find themselves for the first time having to get a job outside the home.
So now, what would you recommend that someone do if they find themselves in this situation? They've been married for many years and had planned on retiring together, also looking at any long-term care together or any health crisis together. What would be the steps that you would recommend putting in place as a single person now? Because now they're going to face long-term care perhaps by themselves or caring for themselves that might require more expenses, might require someone to come in a little bit more than maybe if the spouse was able to do that. So are there a few things that they can put in place to help alleviate all of the extra stress in their life in this way?
Well, I would first say, and I can't resist making this point, encouraging them if there's time and if they're the one who is in a position to choose, as opposed to the one who's being led into this, for them to try to save the marriage, to mm-hmm. think twice and maybe think a third or fourth time.
Mm-hmm.
But to the extent, though, that they're in the process, then it does mean that they have to be more aggressive early on, because the compounding rates that they had of their money when it was a larger pool was such that they had, assuming they did any planning at all, they probably had that coupled with the Social Security and perhaps even a traditional retirement income. They may have been in a position to have lived self-sufficiently without either of them being employed, say, from age 70 on
mm-hmm.
or before even. In this case, they need to do new math, and they need to make some assumptions about the possibility of dwindling health. I think that to the extent that there are risks or questions, maybe based on your medical history, on family history, it may require you to perhaps purchase things such as long-term care insurance that you otherwise wouldn't have, because you had another member in the household, you had other sources of income, and you had twice as much assets. So now you do have to think more about insurance in situations that you wouldn't have before. You also have to think about someone to help you with your care in a way that you didn't before. Children, you know, often they align during these divorces.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
you can expect children to align with one party or the other. Even small children do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I can tell you adult children do that.
Oh, yeah.
So that's going to impact your decision making. Are you going to continue to live in the same city where before you had a spouse and now you don't, and maybe there's another city where your children are living as adults that perhaps you're going to plan on moving? So it means that maybe you don't want to keep the real estate.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's in your interest at the time of the divorce, rather than assume the risk of saying in the divorce settlement, we'll assign a value of $400,000 to my house, when it may not in fact net that. It's better to go ahead and let it be sold during the divorce rather than assume that risk and take the proceeds with the intention of, and if that's handled properly, you can still preserve your tax benefit.
Okay.
For the transfer, for the purchase of a new home. It's kind of halved, essentially, between the parties in that case. But it does mean thinking very differently about the future, and it probably is going to mean that both parties end up working longer than they otherwise would.
Mm-hmm. And I do think you brought up an interesting point, the long-term health or long-term care insurance. So that would definitely be something. A lot of times we look at that and go, oh, well, maybe I'm too old or it's going to get cost prohibitive. But it becomes even a little bit more important when you don't have someone else to help take care of you.
It does. And some of these things should be negotiated in the course of the divorce. When you're older, especially, it's critical for the attorney representing the more vulnerable party, and I'm going to stereotype here a little bit, but often the wife,
mm-hmm.
this was true at least 40 years ago and for those marriages that some are wrapping up today.
Mm-hmm.
So for those people, then, it's especially important that the more vulnerable spouse have an order that gives them the funds to assure proper coverage for insurance. And often that can be negotiated. So rather than perhaps take more in assets, maybe there can be a longer support order. If there's going to be a support order at all, the person who's more vulnerable needs to, at age 65, think a whole lot more about locking in a sum specific for a longer period than, say, a person who's 35
mm-hmm.
or who's 30. So that order could very well provide for the funds to pay for long-term care. There could be a life insurance policy on the opposing party's life that would be especially valuable to perhaps the more financially needy party, since they would be more vulnerable in the event of their death. Remember, they're not by law the recipient of anything that their ex-husband may have earned when he dies. And a judge cannot lawfully issue an order for him to provide support beyond his death. It's a constitutional limitation. So those things have to be voluntarily negotiated, but they often will be, because the attorney representing the husband recognizes that it may be in his client's interest to give the wife peace of mind and in exchange get more assets, but commit to paying more money for a longer period of time. That, incidentally, a big deal now with maintenance in these settlements is that you no longer have the advantage. Used to, husbands would more liberally agree to pay maintenance because they got to deduct the money. So at their higher tax rate, it was advantageous. Mm-hmm. They weren't really paying as much as the check indicated after taxes. But now that beginning, what, the 1st of January of last year, that changed.
Oh, really? So now it's just the amount that you owe, and that's it.
The husband, whoever is paying the maintenance, they still have to pay the taxes on the income. It's like child support for the recipient.
Okay. So now what about Social Security? Do you know anything about that? If you've been married a particular length of time, are you still entitled to perhaps some of the Social Security benefits of the spouse that made more money, or a percentage of that, or anything like that?
So if you've been married 1 year, then after that point, if your spouse dies, you're entitled to receive benefits from their Social Security as a result of that marriage. That's in a situation where you're still living together at the time of the death of one of the spouses and you've been married for 1 year. Regarding divorce, the parties who each party's entitled to an interest in the Social Security of the other if the marriage has lasted for 10 years.
10 years. Okay.
So it's a 10-year period of time when you're looking at divorce, 1 year period of time when you're looking at a widow or widower.
Okay. So it doesn't matter. Does the percentage change at all if you've been married 20 years or anything, or is it just a straight percentage?
It's a straight percentage after 10 years.
Okay.
But I can tell you that Social Security is not going to be the cornerstone of support. It can be helpful, especially when you have a dependent child, mm-hmm. an adult dependent child, for example. But I think that much of the discussion at the time of the divorce has to look at the very real possibility that one of the parties will not have the funds to pay for their cost of living for the balance of their life.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, remember, it's like getting divorced in the afternoon, so to speak, when the sun's going down,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
And when you think of it from the perspective that it's only going to get more difficult, it's going to have less opportunities for recovery, more limited resources, et cetera. I don't want to paint a bleak picture by any means, because certainly people, some can emerge from divorce at any age,
mm-hmm.
and have the balance of their life be wonderful. But I just encourage people to think before they make the decision to divorce, because often what they think is a greener pasture turns out not to be.
So maybe what would be a good idea is, rather than put all of the expenses in the divorce, maybe invest in a marriage counselor.
Yeah. Yeah, that would
at least try that for a few years or for a little bit.
Yeah, marriage counselors, I'll tell you, are far less expensive than divorce lawyers. and everybody and every professional that comes in tow with them.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think, though, that the parties need to realize that's true for both of them, that they will be living with more limited resources than they otherwise would.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think spouses often realize that. They think when they're relieved of the other party, maybe the husband may think that the wife spends too much money. The wife may think if he is the primary breadwinner, the wife may think that she's going to have all this maintenance and life's going to be good. I'll have his money without him. I'll get half of the assets.
Does this sound like the Amazon couple or Jeff Bezos? Or
yeah, minus the money.
Minus the money.
and it just doesn't turn out to be that way. It turns out that both parties struggle more financially. You just sit down and do the math. Here's what I would suggest for those of you who think you're in a position where you may be looking at a divorce, voluntary or not. You should sit down with a CPA early. Mm-hmm. That is an emphatic piece of advice I would give somebody who does some financial planning, and run some scenarios. You probably will need to include your lawyer, because your lawyer will provide the scenarios. Your lawyer will probably give you a couple of them, hopefully not 10,
mm-hmm.
but there should be some predictability. He may say, I think that there will be maintenance. It's probably going to be awarded either in this number on a high end or this number on a low. Or he may say there won't be maintenance. There will be probably a 50-50 division of the assets. So once your financial advisor is armed with these scenarios, then he or she can run the numbers, and you can see firsthand what you're probably looking at post-tax.
Mm-hmm.
And it allows you to develop a plan that's realistic.
Yes, good information at your fingertips is always helpful as you're trying to plan for these unknowns, I guess.
Yeah, and it is an unknown, particularly after a 30-year marriage.
Yeah. So if somebody has done, as we often recommend, and planned ahead, and they put everything into a trust or they have something there, how is that handled? Does that make it simpler or harder?
Well, that's a good question. If they've created an irrevocable trust, then they've probably placed funds outside the marital estate, depending on the way it's worded. But remember, irrevocable means one that you cannot undo. So it kind of acquires this life of its own. So it exists apart from what's called the marital estate, and that's just a word for your combined assets. Now, one thing I should add is that anything that is gifted to either party by way of an inheritance is going to be probably part of the marital estate if it was commingled. Now, by that I mean it's not unusual, particularly for these people who are age 55, 60, 65, 70. They probably have had parents that have passed mm-hmm. away, so there's probably been an inheritance. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you that if they dotted every I and crossed every T, if each of them very meticulously put it into an account in their name alone and assured they didn't what's called commingle other monies with it, then that may very well be a separate asset of that person. So it certainly starts out as a separate asset. Let me make that clear. When when one person inherits an asset, or if they receive a gift, if one parent gives their son or daughter $100,000 to the son or daughter, that is a gift to them alone. It's not a marital asset.
Hmm.
The reason those often become marital assets is what people do with them after they get them.
They put them in a joint account.
They put them in joint accounts, or they commingle. Maybe they put it in a separate account for a while, but then they dump a lot of their earnings in it. And their earnings, believe it or not, they're marital. That's the reason that whenever we talk about one breadwinner who's earned lots of money and it's been a joint account, it's a marital account.
Mm-hmm.
So the earnings during the course of a marriage are marital. So I want people to just, though, be aware that inheritances and gifts are probably going to end up being marital money, and that's going to really frustrate some people hearing this message now. But it doesn't have to have been. But one thing to think about when you're looking at your trust and your estate planning is that don't forget to change your beneficiaries and other provisions that might come along after the gavel goes down,
mm-hmm.
or even maybe before it goes down in your estate planning. Now, I will tell you that there is a statute that protects you. So if you fail to do that, don't count on this, but if you fail to do that, you're probably going to be okay, because there's a statute that for most things says that after a divorce, it's to be interpreted to be that person predeceased you. So whoever would have been next in line to receive that. That statute applies to beneficiary clauses on life insurance. It applies to, of course, your will and various other things. But don't count on it hitting everything. It's best to go in and make all those changes when you can. Now, let me go back, though. You asked a while ago about kind of a trust.
Mm-hmm.
The irrevocable, yes. The irrevocable is depending on if it's set up correctly as an independent entity. And if it is, then that probably will not be a marital asset for either party, probably. Lawyers make money in divorce because they're hired to make arguments to undo those things.
So it just stays there until it goes to the the beneficiaries.
Yeah, it's beyond the control of the parties.
Okay.
And to the extent that it's been set up that way, and often that's the goal for tax purposes, et cetera, spendthrift trust, is it makes it not truly a marital asset.
So if your house is there, it's going to stay there until you pass away.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. It'll be used for the benefit of the beneficiaries. Now, let me hurry to add that to the extent that there's what's called, there's a phrase called fraud on the marital estate. To the extent that one of the parties may have shuffled a bunch of assets in irrevocable trust during the marriage behind the back of the other party.
Uh-oh. Why you're getting divorced?
Yeah, that's going to be a problem. So I discourage spouses from doing that. just because the court doesn't like it, and the court can write things one way or another. They can either undo the transaction, depending on what it is, or they can simply readjust the allocation of the other assets so that the victim is compensated. Now, but let me talk to those situations. Probably the more common one is where there's a revocable trust.
Mm-hmm.
And when it's a revocable trust, there's not a problem because a revocable trust still is fully it's a marital asset. It's one that can be undone immediately. So when it's a joint revocable trust, as the vast majority of estate planning is, then in that case, it's probably going to be treated as the other marital assets. It is possible, I'll mention just quickly, how much time do we have?
We have about 3 minutes.
Okay. It is possible to have what's called a post-nuptial agreement. Sometimes you'll have estate planning that is treated that way, but that means these parties have been having trouble with their marriage for a while.
Oh,
meaning,
okay.
If they're entering into an agreement where they're doing what would be considered post-nuptial planning, in the event of a divorce, this is what we want to happen, and we're doing our estate planning with this in mind. Then,
I never knew you could do that.
Yeah, well, you can, and the court, it has to be not unconscionable, and to the extent that it qualifies, then the court may honor that. But for most purposes, your estate planning is just redone, and it shouldn't affect the allocation of assets. But it's something to think about when you're doing your estate planning. If you see that on the horizon, many don't. I understand that.
Mm-hmm.
And for those with revocable trusts, it would, in all likelihood, not have any impact on the allocation of assets.
Oh, okay. Well, any last advice? We've got about 2.5 minutes left.
My advice would be the same advice going in, and that's to try to save your marriage.
Mm-hmm.
This is coming from somebody who, you know, Cordell & Cordell is one of the largest domestic relations firms in the country. And so we see divorce up close, and we know that, you know, sometimes, yes, it's the right thing sometimes, but all too often divorces happen when I'm convinced that had the parties been more thoughtful and had a little bit more determination to save their marriage, they would have someday been happily celebrating their 50th wedding anniversary.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But for the intervention of some event and one party being impetuous or selfish.
Yeah, I actually have kind of heard some statistics like that, where if you actually will work on your marriage and say 5 years later, you are happier than what you would have been divorced. If you stay committed to your marriage, you're happier in 5 years than what you are. They've gone back and compared couples and things like that. And it's just, I don't know. It's, for me, I think it's worth it.
Yeah, and let me add this, and this is true whether you're a young couple or an older couple, but maybe even more true if you're an older couple. If one of you has met someone, and that often is the trigger, I'm convinced, whether you're mm-hmm. 30, 40, 50, or 60, if you've met someone, and that's what has been sort of the impetus for this decision, think carefully about that. I can tell you in the vast majority of cases that person does not turn out to be who you think they are.
Mm-hmm.
And you may think, well, my husband or wife, I'm not pleased with him or her either. But sometimes the devil you know is a lot better than the one you don't. And I don't want to characterize it that way. But the point is, you may not have a perfect marriage, but no marriage is. And don't assume that this person you've met is going to somehow be significantly better, especially when you're entering this period of your life.
Well, and if you can do that, maybe these statistics can turn around, and then all of the age categories will be reducing in 20 years from now.
Yeah. And just very quickly, this person in this scenario, you really are placing a lot more trust in than that 35-year-old housewife, for example, that's met someone, or husband that's met someone. They can back out of that mistake, not without a lot of consequences, let mm-hmm. me add. But when you're 65 and you're dumping a marriage of 30, 35 years for this other person, you're placing a whole lot of trust in mm-hmm. that person, far more than your 35-year-old self would be. Well, I hope this has been helpful. Another episode of Elder Talk. Till next time, take care.
You've been listening to Elder Talk with Joe Cordell, providing smart solutions for seniors with attorney CPA Joe Cordell. Listen again next Saturday for another edition of Elder Talk with Joe Cordell, sponsored by Cordell Planning Partners, your elder law advisors. For more information, visit eldercarelaw.com. The choice of a lawyer is an important decision and should not be based solely on advertisements.